So many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello and welcome to Geekily Yoked, the world's best married Christian geek podcast. As always, I'm Lehman Kessler.
And I'm Rachel Kessler.
And we are joined today by two very special guests. We are being joined by T. Morris and Pip Ballantyne. Please say hello, folks.
Hi, folks. How are you doing?
We're doing very well. This whole sort of meetup was orchestrated by our good friend Katie Brisky.
Our intern of awesome.
We still miss her.
We miss her terribly.
She's pretty awesome.
Yes, she is.
She came and stayed with us for three whole weeks.
Oh, wow.
Was very, very pleasant weeks.
We really weren't sure.
Taught her something here, and she helped us out.
Yeah, really weren't sure exactly what we would be able to do with a writing intern, and we found out there was a lot of stuff we could teach her, and it was a great education for both of us because we've never had an intern, and she said I've got the writing craft, I've got the basics of the writing craft down okay, I want to learn more about the business, and that's why she hung out with us.
How to author,
as she likes to put it.
Now, how did you guys initiate that? Did she come looking for you, or were you in searching for an intern?
It's your story.
It was
baby.
Mine. Yeah. I think I was talking about how crazy Match was going to be for us, and I sort of wailed to the universe, oh, we need an intern. And then Katie was talking about being at Stone Coast at doing the Masters of Fine Arts in Popular Fiction, I think it is.
Popular Fiction.
And I said, oh, do they do internships? And then she said, no, but I can come and be your intern.
And so she came with she came over here, and it was great timing because we like having company, and it was just on our
we toured around the various historical / and or beer areas in Virginia.
Yeah. Wonderful. Our kid who her online persona is a Sonic Boom. Mm. She just thinks the world of Katie. And it was a terrific.
She helped us shovel snow as well.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
That was very nice.
She didn't help
shovel
snow. She
was great
snow.
At it.
She was a machine. She was a machine. Yeah, she was awesome.
She's Canadian.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Plus 10 to shoveling.
Yes.
To plus 10 to shoveling.
Exactly.
Yep.
I guess we should specify that Katie is a parishioner at my church.
That's right.
Right.
And she
had us
out for the launch of
her book.
Yes.
Hapix.
Oh, Hapix. Yes. Yeah. And she—that was how we actually kind of all got together because we were all with.
She listened to my podcast first.
Well, she listened to your podcast.
I claim rights of firsties.
Okay, you get firsties. One thing we all share in common is that Katie, Pip, and I all wrote for Dragon Moon Press, and it was right before Dragon Con. We were all getting ready to go to Dragon Con, and I got this ping from Gwen Gates, the publisher of Dragon Moon, and she said, "There's this lovely girl coming out. Her name is Katie Brisky. Keep an eye out for her, and just take good care of her this weekend." And we're like, "Okay," and we met with Katie, and we just hit it off automatically. So it's just been going uphill since then, and we're literally when she gets on the plane to come home, we're usually counting the days when she can come back.
Now, what were you guys sort of needing an intern for? This will, I guess, for our audience who may not be familiar with you. What do you two do?
Well, we're both writers of steampunk and fantasy and speculative fiction genre. We write separately and together. And March was going to be one of those months. I had my New Zealand fantasy historical crazy. Awesome.
We really need to work
I need to
on
get
how
on the
you
pitch for that better.
Look, no, you've got it, honey. Okay. Let me do this because obviously the little lady just cannot.
Forgetting about it.
She constantly drops the ball on this, and she's the one that wrote the book. Okay, so she's written a book called Weatherchild. If you want to know what it is, it's Downton Abbey set in New Zealand with wizards.
Wow.
I like it.
Okay.
All right. I like it better than Downton Abbey.
So that came out on the 1st of March. Then we have T's Kickstarter for his Billabub Baddings that is going on. And then we also have the release of the third book of the series that we write together, The Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences. Mm. Dawn's Early Light is coming out on the 25th.
That's what brings us here, and that's what actually brought Katie in as our intern, was that we knew that that was a lot we were putting on our plate, and the main thing we wanted to do was Weather Child was like the B priority, the Kickstarter was sort of the C priority, but we had all this other stuff that we needed to do for the A priority, which is Dawn's Early Light. And we sat down with Katie, and she saw how we brainstormed, how we put together blog tours, and she helped us just keep everything in order.
Keep our brains
keep our brains from in our heads without them leaking out of our ears. To kind of bring you up to speed. So, and also Katie wrote for us.
Oh, okay.
That was another thing while she was here.
Next week.
She was helping us produce. Yes. She was helping us produce Tales from the Archives, which is a Parsec-winning anthology. It's steampunk, and it's set in the same universe as the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences. And we challenged Katie. We said, Katie, we want you to write the most Canadian steampunk you can come up with. And wow, did she pull it up. She knocked it out of the park. I'm not going to give any spoilers away. You just got to listen. It's going to drop her episode, which is called Under Oak Island. That is going to drop on the 11th of March. Okay. And we just had our recent, we actually had our first episode of season three drop, which is called Silver Linings. You can appreciate this being a missionary kid and being a priest. This was a story that we were inspired by a guy named Dennis Reed, who is our youth pastor or youth minister, youth priest. He's the guy that's in charge of the youth at our Episcopal church. And
it's more of a wrangling position.
Exactly. I wondered why he was carrying a cattle prod, hon. Anyway,
and he does have a sheepdog. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, Dennis was talking the story about Judas Iscariot. And he said something that just really stuck in my head. He said, I feel that Judas got a bum rap. And when he said that, something just clicked in my head, and I start making notes on my iPhone, and I'm, you know, Pip's nudging me in the pew, and I'm just like, just give me one second. Because I had to get the idea.
I thought he was tweeting.
Yeah, she thought I was tweeting. And the end result of those notes I took in church while Dennis was giving his sermon, that was Silver Linings, and that is now currently on at ministrypeculiaroccurrences.com. So Dawn's Early Light is the third book in the series. The Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences, the way we describe it to people is it's the X-Files in Victorian England. And the Ministry, they investigate things that are just too weird for Scotland Yard. And it's not just the supernatural they also do. They also do conspiracies and shadowy societies and things like that. And they and mad scientists, they handle them as well. So maybe it's, you know, there's a little bit of X-Files in there. There's a lot of Fringe in there, I'm finding out, because I'm starting to work through Fringe. And the first two books are called Phoenix Rising and The Janus Affair. Dawn's Early Light takes place after The Janus Affair, and it is a cross-country romp chasing mad scientists from literally sea to shining sea. We start in the Outer Banks of North Carolina. We end in San Francisco, and hilarity and explosions and chaos and mayhem
ensue.
Now, when did the series begin?
Oh, 2010 it came out, the first one, right?
No, 2011. 2011? Yes. Yes.
Yes, it must have been 2011.
Because it won the 2011 Airship
Awards. That's right, yes. 2011, right. We sold it in 2010.
We started working on it in 2009.
Yes. So it's been a long, exciting journey with podcasts and role-playing games and anthologies and all sorts of things that we never quite envisaged coming from it.
No.
Because we actually started it off as we wanted to do a podcast for pay. And I didn't want to do all of the work. And so
she wanted to collaborate.
So I thought, I'll collaborate with someone. At least, you know, if it fails, then I've only lost 50% of my, you know, half the work. The agent at the time, my agent at the time, later to become T's agent, said, someone's interested in this book that you've blogged about. How far along is it? And we were like, it's nearly done.
Yeah. we're hammering out words.
We had like three chapters.
Yeah.
Well done.
And then so we sold that one, and it was funny because we originally were going to call the series Books and Brawn. and then called it like Phoenix Rising, Janus Fair, and so forth. And the publisher said, that's a little too cutesy. Well, you got anything else? And I said, well, how about the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences? And they're like, oh, we love that. So they ran with that. Well, then they sold the book to Germany. And according to some friends of ours who are German podcasters, the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences, when you translate it to German, will not fit on one cover.
Oh, right.
So they changed it to Books and Brawn without input from us. So we're like, oh, okay.
Well, that's really good. Had you guys been writing in sort of the steampunk genre before this, or was this your first foray into it?
This was our first foray into it.
I've been itching to write in steampunk ever since I found out what it was.
Yeah, so. Well, it's got the historical flavor that I like, and he likes the gadgets and the Wild Wild West kind of inspired brass and shiny and steamy things.
Yeah, I dig that whole style of the aesthetic. And I've been wanting to write in this for some time, and I got an idea. I was just working on it, and then Pip came up with a podcast for pay, so we went on ahead and we started to mesh ideas, and then it became this series that we were really really crossing our fingers that the community, which is it's a tight community, we wanted to make sure that they enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed writing it. And we were stunned when only a few months after the book had been out, we received what was called the Airship Award. It's put out by SteamCon, and they basically made us, or we were voted by the community as the best in literature for Phoenix Rising. So we were thrilled with that. And then to add to
The award is also awesome. It's a giant tentacle grabbing an airship.
it's a little
it's the coolest looking
it
award.
Is. It's got to be the coolest. And then we wound up on Goodreads. They had their top science fiction of the year, and sure enough, there we were. And we were ranked eighth. But from Goodreads members, we were ranked eighth with Phoenix Rising as best science fiction of that year. Following year with the Janus Affair, we ranked seventh in Goodreads again, and we were just dancing in the aisles. We were the happiest seventh ranked title, on the recording of this podcast, we just got our second review, and the review was pretty glowing. So we're starting to feel everything ramp up, and that's the hardest part. The hardest part about writing isn't writing the book. It isn't editing the book. It's selling the book. I mean, Pip's got an entire rant that she's getting ready to go on her blog about that, about authors that they don't want to be salesmen, but in today's climate, you have to be.
Yeah. Evolve or die.
Pretty much. That's what it is.
There's a lot of self-promotion, and you're sort of expected to do your own publicity, right?
Absolutely. Yes, yeah. I mean, when you're a new author, they want to know what's your platform, you know.
What's your platform?
What's your Twitter?
Yeah. Are you on Facebook? If you're not on Facebook, get on Facebook. You're not on Google Plus, get on Google.
Because you're really responsible for sort of your own self-branding.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. And
which can be exciting and terrifying at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a real issue that authors struggle with. And I even actually heard, I remember being on a panel. I can't remember who the author was, but I remember her saying, oh, that's someone else's job. It's not my job. Mm-hmm. And I remember, and this was like in 2003, 2004. And I looked at her and I said, oh, that's going to change in a few years. Because even back in 2002, when I first was published with Dragon Moon, This was the way I knew with Dragon Moon Press. I knew that this is the way it was when you're an indie author, you know, you are responsible for your
own
marketing.
Just an Indian
author. But then when you get to the big press, they're like, you know, and this is a very odd little thing. This is an odd little quirk about New York publishing. They say, we don't really have the money to promote you. It's because they're using that money to promote James Patterson. They're using that money
Stephen
to promote
King.
Stephen King. And when you see some of their book trailers, you realize how they kind of cut costs. They cut costs by keeping it very, very cheap. But at the same time, it is still money that is going away from that author. That's going from the new author.
New authors
or mid-list. And some have chosen to cry in their beer over it. And some have said, no, I'm going to do something about this, and I'm going to learn how to promote my work. So that's something that when any new author approaches us, when they say, well, what's your best writer advice for me? I look at them square in the eye and say, are you comfortable speaking in front of people? And if they say no, I say, get over it. Because you're going to have to get that.
Well, we heard a story about Neil Gaiman, who apparently is a very shy person. And he realized that he was going to have to talk to people and a lot of them. So he took acting lessons. For that.
I mean, yeah, and that's Neil Gaiman. That's Gaiman. But even he knows. He's like, look, you know, I have to check my attitude at the door, and I have to sit down, and I have to do this signing. It's not just Gaiman. I've heard that from Terry Brooks. I've heard that from Rob Sawyer. I mean, there are a long line of authors I have heard that have all said this is what you have to do in order to survive. And there's an even longer line of authors who go, well, that's not my job. Or they try to dismiss it. And you know, the thing about being a writer is, and I think this is what Katie came to learn with us, was it's not just, you know, having the pipe in one hand and typing with the other, with straightening your ascot when it gets stuffy.
When was it ever like that?
When was it? Well, it was like that in the 19th century because of ascots and consumption.
Yeah, but they were also dying.
That's the other one. Yes, that's right.
They didn't get paid.
That's what Katie came to learn was the business aspect of writing. And it's the toughest part. It's the toughest part of the career.
Now, Katie did something that I thought was very interesting. And then I realized that you guys have been doing it too, which was this releasing podcasts, you know, releasing parts of your story through podcasts or doing kind of fiction as podcasts. I'm a huge podcast junkie. Part of the reason we have a podcast is because I'm such a junkie and, you know, want one more to listen to. But most of what I listen to is stuff kind of like what we do, either conversational ones or kind of news items, a lot of like, you know,
comedy,
a lot of comedy stuff. Right. But I don't listen to a whole lot of fiction podcasts. I did for a while kind of bounce around between Pseudopod and Podcastle and Escape Pod.
Yep.
Read for those.
Yeah.
But the idea is sort of, you know, almost, you know, little, almost audiobooks, you know, serialized audiobooks. That sounded very fascinating to me. So how did you come across that idea, or how did you get interested in that?
Oh, made it up.
Yeah. I'm the guy that made it up. So you got to get into the Wayback Machine to
2005.
I was over 2005. It was actually 2004. I was having a conversation with Gwen Gaides. The second book in the Moravi series was coming out, and she was like, okay, so for the first book, you promoted it by having pirates crash your book launch, and there was a sword fight. It's fun, and I did all this. It was fun. So what are you going to do to top that, T? And I'm like, yeah, what am I going to do? And I started to consider maybe hiring an actress to play Ascana, have her come in. We do martial arts and swords and all this. And then around this, but then of course I was thinking, you know, that's going to get getting expensive. And then I started listening to podcasts around the end of 2004. That was when the Dragon Page started podcasting, and there was an astronomy podcast I was listening to. I mean, this was literally the age when there were 20 podcasts that you could pick from.
Oh, I remember. Yeah, I remember. I think Gaming Steve was the first one I discovered, and then Geeks On after that.
Right. So you have these very niche things, but I'm listening to the Dragon Page, which I'd been a fan of for even longer than that. I struck up a friendship with the guys. They had me on their show back in 2002. And they loved me so much, they would just randomly grab me on and have me on the show whenever they wanted. And they're doing this thing called a podcast. And I thought to myself, what if I took Moravi and I just podcast it? And I figured out all the time, and I figured that if I didn't miss a week, or if I missed a couple of weeks here and there for whatever reason, it would time right before the launch of the sequel. So the idea I had was that everybody would be listening to Moravi, and then by the time they finished it, boom, I could say, guess what? Legacy of Moravi is out now. And I approached Michael R. Meningay and Evo Terra, and they were like, okay, T, that's a big book, but here's what you're going to need. And they told me everything I needed, and I put about $400 into my first rig. And I sat down, and sure enough, by the end of it, there it was. I completed a novel from cover to cover. And at the same time that I was doing this, or rather, right after I launched it, a guy named Martin Jeffrey stepped up, and he said, well, I'd like to podcast my novel. And then another guy named Scott Sigler stepped up and he said, well, I've got a novel that's never been published and I want to podcast it. So we, Evo and I got to talking and we started talking about different, different things we could do. I mean, you know, if the three of us came up with this idea all around the same time, how many other people had this idea? Mm. So, and Evo coined this term podiobook. Instead of an audiobook, it's a podiobook, which means you get it as a podcast. And Evo said, well, why don't we start up a website? And we did, and it was called podiobooks.com. And it's basically a reservoir of free fiction that people do.
That exists to this very day.
Yes.
But it's like 400, 500 titles
now. It's 400, 500 titles now. We have millions of listeners, millions of subscribers. I mean, it's really amazing how fast it grew. And we've got everything. We've got nonfiction. We've got fiction. We've got how-to podcasts. We've got
romance.
Romance. We've got naughty romance. We've got steampunk. We've got dieselpunk. We've got science fiction, horror. I mean, you name it. We've covered all the genres. I think we even have some kids' books up there as well. Huh. So it really is an amazing experience working with the folks at Podio Books. That being said, Pip and I have talked about it before, and we loved the experience of podcasting novels.
I actually podcast more novels than you did.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. But like just
four.
Yeah. But just like me, you're probably never going to podcast no. a novel ever again.
Probably not. No. I think just the amount of work that's involved and how I learned from T, so I do it the same way with lots of special effects and yeah. guest voices and all of that jiggery-pokery that goes on, which makes it a really rich oral experience.
But it's also
very, very time heavy.
Yeah, yeah.
It takes a long time to produce just one episode. So T and I are doing Tales from the Archives, which is the short story companion podcast to the novels. And just getting in a season of 12, 13 short stories, we get in, we make them all sound lovely, I mean, and then
yeah,
we're done.
That's where we found the happy medium for us. Is that we have other people write the stories, do the audio, send it to us, and then we pepper it with special effects, we pepper it with a score, and then we send it, and then we put it out. And people dig that. We've actually gotten some people who had never podcast before come on to Tales from the Archives. They podcast their work. They found out the audience was there. They found out that all these things
it.
To do with it, and they enjoyed it. They're like, yeah, I want to do this too. So finding out that you're a podcast junkie and that you've got your own podcast, and that does not come as a surprise to me. Not at all.
Like a virus.
Well, there's this I found when I, you know, sort of at the height of my junkiedom, that I began to develop this weird sense of, I don't know if it's an inferiority complex or guilt, but I was consuming so much media and just, you know, listening yeah. and listening to all these things. And I wanted to create. Like I wanted to participate. And I felt like there was this real stark dividing line between being a sort of a fan and a sort of a passive receiver of stuff. And, you know, you're part of communities and, you know, those sort of develop. But as opposed to feeling like you're you know, actively going out and creating stuff. And this podcast was part of that. But also when I started doing my web series, Ask Lovecraft, that I really began to get invested in and see a response. And suddenly it dawned on me that there isn't that stark a dividing line between sort of fan and creator. But it's a lot more blurred.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, podcasters. I mean, they're listeners, then they're creators, then they inspire. It is. It's like a viral thing. But there's also a great sense of community and people, you know, exchanging ideas, exchanging promos and stuff like that. I think that's probably why T and I haven't given up on it altogether.
Oh, no.
We do our own short stories, but we also do a chitty chat writer's life kind of podcast called The Shared Desk, which is at theshareddesk.com, which is us sort of keeping our toe in the water, so to speak, and doing something fun and interesting and just being part of the community.
There is a darker side to it though, that I've been noticing it during this Kickstarter. When I set off to do this Kickstarter for the third mystery in the Bit About Batting series, I got a lot of people asking me, are you planning to podcast it? And I said, no. And some people actually got angry with me. And I find that also the ugly underbelly of podcasting is almost a sense of, almost a sense of entitlement. Like, you know, I'm making content for free. You've made content free. You should give it away all for free. No, I don't think that is in our agenda anymore. At one time, I would agree. Yes, it's a great option, particularly for people that are starting off and they want to create an audience for themselves.
Right.
But people have asked us, have you ever thought about podcasting the ministry series? And I'm like, well, one, we can't, but two, even if we had that option, we wouldn't. We're already giving something away for free. We are giving away the Tales from the Archives for free. If people want it in a digital format that they can read, then they pay. But if you want just free fiction, go to ministryofpeculiarcurrences.com, go on ahead, subscribe to the podcast, and you'll get it. And we don't have a problem giving those stories away because they're great stories and they're a lot of fun to tell. But it's when people start getting entitled to the free content that I'm like, no, we're all working hard here. And I think that's why so many podcasts kind of fall by the wayside, because suddenly people are like, there's a lot of demands for this. I'm like, well, yeah. I mean, if you're podcasting, podcast not for the ratings. Don't do it for the riches, because that's not going to happen either. But if you're enjoying it, by all means, do it.
But do you find that by and large, people are willing to pay, for lack of a better word, for the content that they find valuable? I mean, I know it's something Lehman and I have talked about quite a lot, that, I mean, we have a lot of free podcasts that we listen to, but we give voluntary donations to them because we feel like that's simple. Like the Maximum Fun family of podcasts, we're big fans of. Yeah. And we're... you're not required to donate, but we've been donors to Maximum Fun for about 2 years now, because we like it and we want them to be able to do more and interesting things. So we feel like it's our responsibility to help them do that.
Yeah. I was actually investigating this very evening, a new thing called Patreon, P-A-E-T-R-O-N,
yeah.
Which is, I mean, there have been various things where it's micropayments,
yeah.
You know.
Okay.
This is the newest and shiniest. Whether it actually takes off will be another question. I often wonder what would have happened if we had actually podcast Books and Brawn as a podcast. I have a feeling it probably wouldn't have made that much money.
No, I don't think it would have.
But, yeah, I mean...
There are people that have hit it big with podcasting, and I wish I knew what their magic bullet was, because I would have loved to have duplicated that magic bullet.
I think it's just lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of content.
I think it's that. I think it's also subject matter too. You know, there are more
tech
people.
Stuff.
Yeah, well, there are more people that wanted to know tech stuff, and Grammar Girl, of course, hit it big with her Grammar Girl podcast. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't think there is such thing as a magic bullet. I mean, for a while there, at the Portable Media Expo, the last year it was in Ontario, California. The overall pervading theme was sex. And they were like, that's how you make your money in podcasting.
Really?
Get some raunchy, skanky hoes dancing and shaking their moneymakers on
audio.
I feel like there's a problematic medium there.
You have to make use of creative cast a net. That's really
well, cool. Look, there's someone here now. Look,
you know, you would, you know, honestly, it was some of these were video podcasts. Some of these were Howard Stern wannabes, and they were all, they were like, this is going to be the game changer. This is going to be the game. And I'm like, no, it's not. And some people made it big, some didn't. Some never hit that. And my thoughts were it was an education, and I've seen people just say, oh yeah, give it away, because some people, and there are some success stories in there. You know, you've got your Scott Siglers, you've got your Cory Doctorows, you've got your John Scalzi's. I mean, they all at one time gave their works away for free, and they went to bigger and better things. Now, if you were to say, well, of those three, who's the one that probably made the most of it? I would say it's Cory Doctorow, because he continues to give all of his works away for free. And he is still extremely successful as a science fiction author, but also as a public speaker and things like that. Scalzi gave away Old Man's War. That was his first book. Uh-huh. Since then, I don't think he blogged any of his other books, nor does he really podcast that much. But he has a great social media following because of his blog. And as far as Scott Sigler is concerned, he has also been successful with it as well. He has decided, though, to go more into the independent publishing route. Good on him. And he's doing the same thing. He's given a lot of his works away for free. But I just feel like
the industry that I follow that pretty much, you know, starts with the give it away for free and then kind of make money on the back end was the webcomics community. For a long time, I was a huge, huge fan of Webcomics Weekly, which was a podcast put out by Scott Kurtz and Dave Kellett and Christopher Straub. And it was actually fascinating because I didn't actually read a whole lot of webcomics. I read some of theirs, but not everyone's. But it really inspired me to just create. They talked about the creative process. They talked what you've, you know, talked about right now about do what you love doing and don't, you know, instantly think, okay, you know, when can I start selling T-shirts? When can I start asking for donations? You know, do what you're already loving to do. And then, you know, after so many years, you know, a following will presumably begin to, you know, form if you're good. You know, this is predicated on there being a certain amount of talent, not just sort of recycling what you're saying. And it was just deeply, deeply inspiring to, you know, for me thinking of myself as trying to go out and be an independent creator and make something. A lot of their lessons really still stick with me.
Well, I would think that I also believe, too, that the magic bullet is different for everybody. I believe our magic bullet for podcasting, particularly for podcasting, is the Tales from the Archives. Mm-hmm. Because what's been great about the Tales from the Archives, I can't think of a down, you know, people are like, that's a lot of time and resources you're investing. I can't think of a down aspect of doing Tales from the Archives, because here's where it's win across the board. One, we get these talented friends to write for us, and we pay them, not a lot, but we do pay them to write for us, and they get affiliated with the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences, because what they're writing we consider to be canon. Well, then it turns out that these talented people decide they want to bring something new to our universe, and we're like, wow, we'd have never thought that. So in a weird way, we're crowdsourcing our universe, and you know, if we give it the
it's
thumbs
like the expanded
up,
universe of Star Wars.
Exactly. And then on top of that, we get people that listen to the podcast. They go, I'm really enjoying this. And then when they hear us say, you know,
go buy the book,
they buy the book. But then we get these other group of people who buy the book, they get on their blogs and they rave about the book, and we go, and they always end with, I can't wait for the next book. So we go, well, you do know there's a podcast. And of course we get the, what's a podcast?
Oh, so there's a nice feedback loop.
Yeah. And then suddenly we get all these new listeners that come on board and they go, oh my God, I have 25 brand new stories set in this universe. That's awesome. And then they all geekgasm, and it continuously feeds itself, and we sell them
as ebook singles and little collections. Yeah. As well.
Okay. So we sell them as what
for
we call
people, for people who don't like the audio. Right. I don't know who those people are, but there are some.
There are some. And we don't call them penny dreadfuls. We call them 99 penny dreadfuls. Oh, nice. Because they're 99 cents. And of all the different ebooks that we have out, those are our top selling ones, are the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences short stories. And then to feed that snake even more, just last year I got pinged by Bain Publishers, and Bain Books called me up and they said, I was going through some different stories on my Nook, and I came across this wonderful little short story called In the Spirit of Christmas. Do you own the rights to this? And I go, well, yes, I do, because we had self-published it. And the guy was like, I'd love to have this in our next anthology, A Cosmic Christmas to You. And I was like, sure. When do you need it? The guy was like, by the end of this week. So So I did a quick turnaround, and a story that I essentially did for free, I got paid to reissue. And it's the only steampunk in this holiday anthology that made its way in print. And I was extremely proud of that, because that basically makes, at that time, it was the third publisher that the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences had appeared in. It's Harbor Voyager, Ace Books, and now Bane. So,
And Imagine That.
And then we got Imagine That, which is four. And then
Steampunk World. I think that should be coming out soon.
Yeah.
Steampunk anthology of multicultural steampunk from around the world.
And again, these are all short stories that either we have written or other people have written in our universe for us. So there has not been, this has been our magic bullet. Because people that didn't know about the podcast discovered after they read the books. People who discover the podcast first, they go out and they buy the books. So it's just been a win-win across the board.
Now, when did the role-playing game start up?
Again, I defer to Pip, because
that's kind of my fault.
Yeah.
Well, we know this gentleman called Brennan Taylor from Galileo Games, and we were at a convention in Baltimore called Balticon. And I just walked up to him and said, ha ha, you know, wouldn't it be funny? The Ministry would make a great role-playing game. And then I kind of slapped him on the back and walked off. And then a couple of months later, he was like, so, Pip, you know, when you pitched me the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences as a role-playing game, and I was like, what? Oh, yeah, that, then, yes, what? Okay. So they picked it up and ran with it, and we turned it into a Kickstarter. We rolled it in together with our anthology, because we had a gap in the publication last year where there was going to be no Ministry novel. So we wanted to have something as a sort of a, you know, tide people over. So we put it together with the role-playing game, and we ran a very successful Kickstarter. We got 152% of our...
Yep. Oh, wow.
Of our goal, and we
got a lot of shiny new add-ons. We got steampunk dice created for the game, and
it's Q Workshop in Poland.
We've been absolutely thrilled with the with the anticipation of the Ministry initiative. It should be coming out. We're gonna say
March,
in April.
April.
April, darling, April.
All right.
It's out of our hands. Yes. It's out of our hands. It's all running on Galileo Games.
We got our we did our protocol.
Yep.
Ministry protocol. Thrilling tales from the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences. We got a beautiful cover shot by our friend Alex White, who hired a train and a plethora of wonderful models, and did us a whole cover shoot. And so we got that out. We produced that. We got the we got a villain supplement for the role-playing game, because we got one of our stretch goals. We got a research and development, so people will be able to go down to research and development and make their own steampunk weaponry and gizmos and gadgets and things. So, yeah, we're pretty excited about seeing it.
And you're using the Fate system, is that correct?
We're using the Fate system. And so it was kind of cool, because the Q Workshop people, they had never done steampunk Fate dice. And when we pitched it to them, they were like, okay, well, here it is. And they showed us the photo of them, and we were just like, oh my God, they're beautiful. And the big box
of them arrived.
Yeah, and it was funny though, because when I sent the email to the guy saying they look gorgeous, he actually sent back a reply saying, just wait until you see them, and because you could just hear the pride in his voice through the email, but. He did a great job. That's Q Workshop. Just do a search for them online, and they'll
one of the few places that do
custom dice. But he went on ahead and he did that for us. It's based on Fate Core. You're a Ministry agent, and you get a gadget, and both you and the gadget have aspects.
Oh, okay.
So we're chomping at the bit to play this game. We've seen artwork from the game. We've seen, you know, we've been
so close, we can almost taste it.
Yeah.
Knowing us, it'll come out at exactly the same day as the third book.
It's going to come out in April, darling. It's going don't make me throw the bell at
no,
you.
No, knowing us.
It's going to come out in April.
Now you two actually not just have helped make this game, but you guys game yourself, correct?
We do. We actually make time for gaming, because the boom is nine.
We're not doing role playing games yet.
No,
okay.
Although we might introduce her to that eventually.
Yeah. Well, she came up with the idea
of the villain supplement.
The villain supplement.
Oh. She wants to play a villain. I'm sure she wants to play a villain.
Yeah, yeah, we're raising her right. but actually, we've got a couple of favorites that we play.
We play Ticket to Ride.
We love Ticket to Ride. I don't know if you've had the pleasure of playing the game.
Oh, I have. Indeed.
We've only done the first one, the original Ticket to Ride. We have not done Ticket to Ride India. We haven't done Ticket to Ride Europe. I've heard great things about both. We're gonna work ourselves up to that.
We play various other. She's starting to get into various other games. So we played Pacific Rim card game, which
Shuffling the deck. Yeah. But I think our favorite game is a game called Dixit.
Oh, I know Dixit. That's a great game.
Oh, it's a fantastic game. And it was funny because we weren't sure how Boom was going to react to the idea of the game. And she took to it like a duck to water.
Yeah, she's got some sort of creativity in there somewhere.
And we're trying to nurture that creativity. And she really wanted to play Dixit tonight. But we said, no, we have a podcast to do tonight. So no, we cannot do the pod. No. But there'll be other times. And we do. I think Dixit was so popular that we actually got the expansion pack the week after we had the game in the house. So yeah, we loved it. And of course, when she goes to bed, it's Cards Against Humanity.
Oh, well, our daughter is 4 months old, so we haven't quite got around to playing.
Yeah, she might chew on the cards for Dixit, so you might want to.
It's largely where did you puke today?
Yeah, exactly.
Although we just heard one of our listeners and very good friends. He has a boy and a girl, and his boy's about 4, and he's just made a hack for Pandemic. That's a bit more kid friendly. I think they're calling it Pediademic or something like that.
Pandemic.
He also made a toddler version of Arkham Horror.
Well, I think he's working on
that. Oh, he's working on that. Yes.
Wow. He's trying to figure out a way to sort of, you know, slim things down a bit and maybe shave, you know, take the edge off some of the more squeamish elements.
And I think I admire that because you know, start them young. Like I said, I mean, I just recently did a gaming blog for somebody. He asked me for a column to review stuff, and I started reflecting on how I myself was getting slowly pulled back into gaming, and I realized one of the reasons why I'd stopped gaming was because I was having the worst experiences. Magic the Gathering. I would do elemental decks. I would focus on one element. I would focus on two elements. I would focus on armament in one. And any time I played with friends, I was out within 30 minutes.
Huh.
So that was my first big gripe. Then I played Killer Bunnies, and that was considered the podcaster's card game, and it reminded me a lot of family experiences with Monopoly, and when you put family and Monopoly together. You know, bad stuff is going to happen. Yeah. It's like
you add in Christmas or Thanksgiving, you've got a great evening.
Oh, heck yeah. So that was, you know, because if the rules weren't cutthroat, they were extremely complicated. And I was just like, I have expansion packs that are still in the shrink wrap for Killer Bunnies. And then there's the Munchkin Cthulhu. Everybody raved on Munchkin Cthulhu. I was so excited. I was finally going to get a chance to play it. I sit down. What happens? I get the death card on the first round, and I went, screw Munchkin Cthulhu, and I haven't played any of the Munchkin games since.
And yet you played poker with the people at the writer's retreat.
Because that's a real game.
Oh, dear.
You still lost.
I lost terribly.
Well, once Munchkin Cthulhu makes it into a James Bond movie, it'll be considered a real game as well, so.
There you go. There you go. I see you have the Death God 007.
Rachel and I did a little bit of role playing together because that's really my background is as a role player with D&D and Paranoia and Star Wars and all that stuff. Rachel, however, did the majority of her gaming when we weren't in the same country. as soon as we got married, as soon as I came up to Canada, we gamed a little bit. But it didn't quite work out. And gaming, as I've gotten older, has been hard just because you're trying to, you know, schedule the same 4 people together at the same time.
Yeah, that's kind of what happened with me. I did Shadowrun and D&D and Warhammer and all of that sort of stuff. But then, you know, people get married and they have kids and you're trying to, you know, juggle.
Jobs.
Yes. It's very sad.
Yeah, people don't want to sleep until 4 in the morning. That's so weird.
Yeah, strangely. Exactly. And they don't just want to eat like Doritos and drink like
Mountain Dew.
Mountain Dew.
Or I guess today it's Red Bull. I guess, just down some Red Bull and some Fritos, and man, that's a lunch, you know.
But once we have our own role playing game, then that's when we must make it happen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's a job.
No, actually, I'm looking forward to gaming again because, again, like I said, I used to love Dungeons and Dragons, I mean, I still have my original dice set. I mean, it's just one of those things where I genuinely miss doing it, but when you get into, and then of course it's not just scheduling the time to do it. There's also you know, the deadlines that you have, and you know, as a writer, and it just gets harder and harder to game. But I have a feeling that when the Ministry Initiative, that's the name of the role playing game, the Ministry Initiative, when that comes out in April, it's gonna probably get me back into gaming again.
You're gonna force yourself, right?
Yeah.
Once they pull me out, they pull me back in. You know?
Well, that's how I eventually got into board gaming, was I realized it was a lot easier to schedule four different people together than the same four people.
Yeah, yes, there is that.
And to schedule them for one
discrete
one event, as opposed to
a game that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Although a lot of the games that we have beginnings. I'm a big fan of sort of sprawling games like Talisman, or I just discovered Tales of the Arabian Nights, which is absolutely wonderful.
It's the Arabian Nights. That sounds good.
It's amazing. Like it's a game of pure storytelling. There is sort of an in-game scenario, but really it's about
the journey.
Precisely. It's about the fact that in one game, my character was going on a hunt to taste all the great foods of the world, wound up trying to help a wizard who made him marry a giant ape. And then he went to the Sultan of Rome, which I can only assume was the Pope, who gave me the option of annulling that marriage. And so, like, these strange narratives kind of develop as you play, but they're so much fun.
It sounds like my 21st birthday party.
There we go.
I mean, really, wow. There have been some board games we've been eyeballing. There's one. The other time when I do find those rare pockets of time, unfortunately, I'm going to have to go back and go through strategy guides and go, okay, where did I leave off in this game? There were two video games that I was really, really fond of. The reboot of Tomb Raider is absolutely gorgeous. Just absolutely breathtaking, gorgeous. The only other game that I think outshone Tomb Raider for me was BioShock Infinite.
Oh yes.
And they have a board game that's a spinoff of BioShock Infinite called BioShock: The Siege of Columbia. And this is apparently the board game. The board game is what's happening when Booker DeWitt phases from one universe to another, and you notice that in one universe everything's in order, but then when he phases into the other universe, the war has happened. It has already happened. Apparently, the Siege of Columbia is what happens between those two worlds.
Oh wow!
And I'm like, oh, I really want to get into that. but then comes the budgeting, and I'm going, yeah, I'm gonna have to pay the gas bill first. That's on my radar. Most definitely on my radar.
Well, that is the fun joy of trying to balance life and fun. I've just started up being a full time stay at home dad. You know, you think, oh, well, you know, you sort of have a lot of time to do things, but really, you have a lot of time to between naps of preparing for naps and trying to like run around and like clean up as you know what you can while they're awake, and then it's been a very interesting shift for me. But you know, I still luckily have the opportunity to make my web series and to do this podcast and to. You know,
and you see, and that's the other thing too that kind of takes me away from gaming and takes Pip away from gaming, because we have this addiction to podcasting. You know, we want to continue the shared desk, we want to continue working with Tales from the Archives, and then we have other bad addictions. Just to make sure that Pip is aware of it, and that we're all aware of what's going on. I cleared the DVR tonight so that in case we went into the 10 o'clock hour, I would still be recording Hannibal.
Oh, yes.
Because I have to be watched. I mean, there's Hannibal, and then there's True Detective, and then
Game of Thrones.
And then there's Game of Thrones is coming, and then there's Archer. I don't think Pip and I really do mainlining. On the rare occasion, we will mainline a series, but usually we tend to watch it one at a time. Or if it's a series that's gone its way, then we don't mainline it. We usually watch it one episode at a time, usually when we're exercising or something like that. But our current addictions of do not call us, because if you do call us, we will not answer the phone. There's actually three shows. There's and they all follow a very disturbing trend. There's Hannibal, True Detective, and Helix. And I don't know if you've seen Helix or heard anything about Helix, but that has wound up to be a sort of a sleeper hit for me and Pip.
I've been hearing things. IO9 has been posting a lot about Helix.
Yes. Yes, they have.
But I haven't seen it.
The most disturbing thing I find about Helix is there's all these terrible pandemic sort of things going on. Mm. And then they have elevator music.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. At least twice. This has got to be something Ron Moore came up with. I just have this picture that, you know, because I met Ron Moore at a podcast convention, because Battlestar Galactica was the biggest like mainstream podcast that was on at the time. And I remember when he showed up, all the podcasters were turbo geeks, but they were turbo tech head geeks. They weren't turbo sci-fi geeks.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So they were all kind of offended that Ron Moore showed up to give his keynote without wearing a tie or proper shoes. I'm sitting there going, he is Ron effing Moore. He can wear a burlap sack. Yeah. And it'll be fine. Well, anyway, so he was like very laid back and all this stuff, man. And I just picture him in this production, because he's the executive producer of Helix.
Oh, really?
And I picture him going, okay, in every episode, I want to hear elevator music twice. And I want the opening theme of this horror, of this very scary pandemic horror show, to be elevator music. And they all roll with it. I mean, like, okay, Ron, whatever you say. And it works, because, I mean, like this one woman is convulsing. There's black ooze coming out of her mouth. And in the background, you hear, I'm like, oh, this is twisted. I want to look away, but I can't.
Moore's always been really good, though, at blending those things. We've been going back, and I've been showing Rachel sort of systematically Deep Space Nine.
Ah, uh-huh. Yes, good stuff, Deep Space.
Although
we kind of hit season 7, and then
Vic Fontaine showed up, and that kind of dried up.
There's so much Ezri Dax.
There's a lot of Ezri Dax, and
so we sort of stalled.
It's been hard, but yeah, Rachel also will like blitz through TV. Like Rachel just destroyed all of Orphan Black.
Oh no, that's good stuff. Orphan Black,
like 2 days.
Wow.
I mean, you know, having a small child helped you. Burn through TV when you're sort of trapped in a chair nursing.
Well, I tell you, if you're looking for a good, since you're done Orphan Black and you're familiar with the whole BBC approach to things, if you're looking for a good procedural cop drama with tortured characters, and one character in particular who just gets so tortured at the end of every season, you just want to give him a hug, look up Luther.
I've actually been watching Luther.
Yeah, Netflix,
it's on Netflix. I've been watching it because I love Idris Elba, and I've heard it's absolutely amazing. And
not as much as I do.
And I mean, it's been fascinating, especially comparing it to Hannibal, because I feel like there's a bit of crossover there. Hannibal is one of the few shows that Rachel and I really can't blitz through.
Yeah, I can TV, and I have to watch Hannibal one episode at a time.
It takes time to digest.
As a matter of fact, the other show that you wouldn't want to blitz through is the other show we mentioned called True Detective.
Liam has been watching.
Which is funny enough, I blitzed through the first three episodes in one evening. I think while dandling my sleeping daughter, which was a strange.
we totally hooked Katie onto True Detective, and then she had to go back, and it was like an episode 6. She was like, "How am I gonna? What? I'm not gonna find out what happens." But she found a source of HBO. So.
Well, see, I'm in the Lovecraftian world with all the, and you know,
So you got to be eating it up.
They're just been going crazy. Like, I actually, I'm part of a book club, and we went through an all red King and Yellow, and
you're all crazy.
Well, so I'm really sort of giggling to myself about, you know, folks, you know, being really interested in True Detective and going out and finding about King and Yellow and reading it, because I don't know if you've read King and Yellow.
No,
but it's a 19th century. Anthology of short stories by the one's author, Robert Chambers, the first three or four of which are in sort of incredibly dark and sort of horror-y, and you can sort of see, okay, so this is, you know, I understand, you know, why Lovecraft picked up on this, and you know, I can definitely see where True Detective is coming from. But then the second half are all these strange short stories about artists in Paris.
Really?
And there is no horror element aside from like just the angst of relationships and who is sleeping with whom. And it's, you're going, wait, what, wait.
Which is probably why people went mad when they read the book. Because I was like, wait a minute.
They would have thought that he would start with the Paris stuff first and then go to the horror.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre. Because again, the first one, especially, I mean, the first one is, the name of which eludes me, but that's, I think, the most famous of them, which is this bizarre sort of dystopian world that's being presented and has kind of bizarre suicide boxes and things like that. But, and lots of reference to the King in Yellow. But it very quickly moves away from that. And it's definitely worth a read. Like it's really great atmosphere. Even the tales of young artists, you know, being bohemian in Montmartre is worth checking out, but definitely a gear shift. Definitely going to be interesting to see people go, wait, what did I just read?
So what you're saying is at the end of True Detective, they'll end up in Paris.
Well, that's what we're waiting for. We're
drinking
coffee,
being angsty.
You know, Cole to, you know, end the series by putting on a beret and being, I have to do my.
I can actually see him sitting outside a little cafe smoking in an angry fashion and sort of commenting on people as they walk past.
Thursdays are my days off, bonsoir.
Louisiana has that French connection, so.
Yes.
There's that.
That's true.
I mean, yeah, the funny thing was, I can't remember, I think Pip read something about True Detective. And said, yeah, let's watch this. Or we might have seen a commercial.
I think we saw a brief commercial. And I was like, huh, McConaughey and Harrelson. That's an interesting combo.
And she turned it on. And I was like, yeah, I'm gonna continue working. You can waste your time with it. But then I started noticing that I was getting fewer and fewer words on the pages because I kept getting sick. Wait, back it up. What did he just say? And then by the end of the first episode, I was like, holy crap, what's the second episode? So we saw the first two episodes back to back. And we were like, wow, this is good. And then, but what's been so fascinating about True Detective is watching sci-fi geeks lose their minds over this series.
I mean, IO9 is covering it. I mean, it's not genre. I don't think it's
going
to be.
No, there's nothing really.
I suspect there's going to be no Cthulhu at the end. I don't think Cthulhu's going to rise out of the bayou.
I think that's what people are hoping for, but it ain't going to happen. No, it ain't going to happen.
No.
And I think
it's going to be a far more horrifying thing to me, because it's going to be a human horror.
I hope we discover that man is the real monster.
Because
it has a lot of references to the King in Yellow. They talk about Carcosa. Talk about literally the King in Yellow, and Lovecraft took a lot of inspiration from King in Yellow. Like the coolest thing about King in Yellow is that in the short story collection is they keep referring to this play, the King in Yellow. Okay. And like, it's, you know, they'll go to someone's house and there's been a murder or something strange has happened, and they will find a copy of this play there. Or someone will say, I just went to see a performance of the King in Yellow, and then they're being driven mad. So it's kind of this Necronomicon sort of thing, you know, this evil book that's tainting things.
And I think that's part of what people have said, the Marty's ex-wife is in on it. No, I don't think that. People have said that Marty's the Yellow King, Cole's the Yellow King. I'm like, no, it's like, and it's funny because the creator of the show, he actually went on record, and I applaud him for this, because I really do think that M. Night Shyamalan really needs to sit back and go, I need to reinvent myself, because now whenever people use the word M. Night Shyamalan, it's usually in a negative context.
Yeah,
because he went on record for saying, I'm not going to do what M. Night Shyamalan does.
I think it's cheap.
And he's right. I mean, it worked in Sixth Sense. It worked in Unbreakable. It hasn't worked for him since, but he keeps going back to that. And I really wish he would stop it. But I think there are people that, because they've been burned by quote unquote wacky twist endings that come out of the left field, they're now expecting it. And the creator has come out and said, I'm not going to do that. You know, I think didn't he go so far as to say it's not Cole and it's not Marty?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because why would you invest all this time in these two wonderful characters, these wonderful, flawed characters, and have them be this criminal mastermind? If that happens, I'll be like, if I ever see this guy's name tacked on any project, I'm never going near it.
What I really like is that they're doing the same thing that American Horror Story is doing, and it's going to be a contained story each season.
Oh, that's great.
I really like that model. I think that's...
It is interesting because something in has happening in publishing as well, where the anthology is making a comeback.
Yeah.
It used to be like the ugly redheaded stepchild kind of thing going on with the anthology, but now it's starting to come back. And then American Horror is doing anthologies, and now True Detective apparently is going to be an anthology series as well. I think it's really awesome. I mean, you don't have to worry about your story getting stale because you're going to have new characters and new settings and new mysteries and stuff going on.
And going back, I do want to say that going back to twists and plots and things like that. And believe it or not, I am going to tie True Detective in with the Ministry of Peculiar Currents.
Okay, so go.
You watch this.
Go for it.
Watch what I do here. So we do have some, some reveals in both, particularly in book three.
Yes.
And we have another book reveal in, we have a big reveal in book four as well. But book three, we actually finally draw the curtain back on a
and
few.
And go, hey, look what's been happening.
Yeah, hey, look at what's been happening. But here's the difference between what we're doing, what True Detective is doing, and what M. Night Shyamalan does. And to some extent, I was one of those people that was okay with the end of the Battlestar Galactica, the reboot. But there were some things that I was like, that's the best you got for some of the plot lines. I was like, really? That's the best you got for Starbuck? She's freaking Clarence and she just got her wings. But I was willing to roll with that. I was willing to roll with that a little bit. But the difference is that we've been building up to these reveals. I mean, we knew in the first book.
It's the old put the gun in front of the the fireplace.
Yeah.
If you're going to use it.
If you're going to use it. And we've had that. We have not just had that gun on the mantelpiece. We've had the gun on the mantelpiece with the bullets. We've had people loading it as we've been going through two books. And in the third book, we finally pull the hammer back and go, all right, here it comes. So we are not pulling any of the stuff out of our butts. But when you see writers do that and they think they're being clever, the trees, really, M. Night Shyamalan? The trees are trying to kill us?
Not just that, office plants.
It was The Happening, I think.
Oh.
Yeah, The Happening, yeah.
You can't outrun the wind, M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just, to me, that type of writing, and you can see it when and it's a bad thing. It's a really terrible thing when you see authors write themselves, you know, whether they're book or screen authors, when you see them write themselves into a corner, and then they suddenly decide, I'm going to wave a magic wand and poof, it's all this.
I do not think that that's going to happen in True Detective.
Oh, it's not. I'm going to go on record.
I think it's good old-fashioned storytelling with great characters, wonderful setting, a really nice feel to it.
And we say that because it's been so good up to this point. Not just from a writing standpoint, but from a performance standpoint. I also do some video editing on the side. So that massive, if you remember in episode four.
I haven't gotten this that far. I've only gotten to episode three, but I've heard about episode four.
Yeah, the tracking shot.
In episode four, there is a 6-minute tracking shot.
Wow.
And from the film buff and the video editor in me watches that. I must have watched that scene in one day, like four times. And it just gets more and more compelling every time I see it because I go, This is a filmmaker's dream to be able to just say, okay, I want to capture the chaos that's happening in the moment, and we're gonna do it this way. And even the director said, yeah, we shot it, and we said, we'll look at the dailies and we'll find an edit point in there somewhere. And we looked back and we was like, no, it's good. Let's just leave it, you know. And it's just, it is, it's not just a great episode, but it's an astounding moment. It's a linchpin in the series. And you see a dynamic change in both Cole and in Marty. And it's just, oh my God, what a great show.
Honestly, I gotta
I'm feeling
it.
Sold on it now.
There we go.
Yes.
And then there's, and then like you said earlier, then there's Hannibal, and we just love Miles. Just love mods. I mean, I'm a big fan of Anthony Hopkins. And I can say.
But you wouldn't sit down to dinner with him. He would scare you.
Yeah, he would scare me. Even if he was wearing a regular suit.
You're like, I would sit down and have dinner with that man.
Well, he charms you, right?
Yes.
Exactly.
He's always beautifully dressed.
Oh my, he's got great suits.
They filmed this here in Toronto, and I worked at a bookstore for a while. And while I was not there one day, Mads Mikkelsen came and checked out.
Oh.
And what my coworkers sent me this message on Facebook being like, I just checked out Matt Mickelson. He dresses that nice all the time.
And you know, I could see that because the guy's got a reputation.
Was he getting out a cookbook?
he was there with his wife and his family and his children. Apparently he was very lovely and not murdering anyone, which is very nice.
That you know of. Yeah.
But that's the thing. I mean, I've actually said to people, and I've gotten into some serious debates about this with, you know, as much as I love Anthony Hopkins and as much as I love Brian Cox in the roles of Hannibal Lecter, I really think Mods has become my Hannibal. I mean, he's the guy that I would just stick the apple in my mouth and I would just say,
you have to say, yes, he's a lot more believable at not being discovered. Whereas Anthony Hopkins, I'm like, you know, when you look across at somebody like that with that sort of look out of your eyes going, I hate this
You
kid.
Will tell me with a slam foot.
But then I love that when the veil gets pulled back and you see what's beneath it and you see that
brokenness.
The psychotic killer of Hannibal that just get it in like little moments.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when those moments happen, they're very subtle, but they're also terrifying. Friend of ours was talking about one of his favorite moments, and I'm like, oh yeah, that was a good moment. Mods was Hannibal was standing in the back of one of Will's classes, and Will was talking about the copycat killer.
Right.
He's talking about how the copycat killer was this and this and that, and he was close to what this other guy did, but what was lacking in here, he was lacking this crime scene has a certain finesse. And as he's talking about the copycat killer, you see Hannibal for just a brief moment grin.
Huh.
like yeah.
I am awesome.
I am freaking awesome. And so the funny thing is, when I first heard that he was going to be Hannibal, I'm like, I'm not going to get past him as Le Chief. He will always be the Bond villain from Casino Royale.
The blood crying Bond villain.
Yes.
No, yeah. He's bitter as Hannibal.
But as Hannibal, I'm just like, oh, I love this guy.
Well, that's why I was turned off from Hannibal at first, was because I was like, what? The blood crying guy? What? No, thank you. Well,
no, but
that would put you off having dinner if a guy's just like blood out of his eye.
But then, you know,
not having anything. Thank you.
You talk about a geek smorgasbord. There was this one episode last year. You had Le Chief serving dinner to Morpheus and Zoe.
I know.
This is geek nirvana.
And then he went off and had a psychiatric discussion with Scully.
With Scully,
who is looking mighty fine, I might say.
That's been the thing that I've been the most curious about now with Hannibal. What does Gillian Anderson's character know?
Yeah,
she's got something on him, and he's got something on her because he won't
let her.
That's a weird, funky kind of relationship happening there.
Although I loved the line, in last week's episode about how. They don't know what you're capable of. Neither do you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. That was a great moment.
Yeah.
She has a hint though, I think. And that's enough.
I know. Just, there's just so much happening.
And have you seen where in tonight's episode, she leans forward and says to Will, I believe you.
Oh, nice.
Oh, wow.
No, we haven't. We're going to have to.
We don't have very good TV reception, and it doesn't the network that shows it up here in Canada doesn't stream it, so we have to buy it on iTunes and get it tomorrow.
So we're gonna have to wait a little bit, but before we run off and let you guys go watch Hannibal, you mentioned that in your newest book you actually had a character roughly based on your priest, and given that my wife here is a priest, I thought that would be very interesting to hear about.
I'm gonna let Pip take the lead on this story for a bit. Talking about how we found Trinity Episcopal Church in Manassas, Virginia.
Yes. So I was born and raised and lived most of my life in New Zealand. So I went to an Anglican school. And so when I came over to America and tea with his kind of tangled religious history, let me look for an Episcopalian version here. So I found a blog post about this place, Trinity in Manassas. And I was like, oh, T was driving, I think, at the time. Yeah, and I was like, yeah. Hey, look, T, there's a priest called Vinny. And I started doing, hey, it's Vinny. You
hey,
know?
Vinny. Yeah, you know, hey, Vinny. Hey, you know what? We're going to sit there. We're going to talk about God. We're going to have a nice canoe. Yeah, everything would be great.
So we did that for like an hour.
Until
I find another blog post where there's a picture of Vinny. And I realized, it's a very nice blonde lady. And I was like, oh, we got to change that.
And on top of that, Vinny had a great blog post about being Christian, being a priest, and being a gun owner.
Oh.
And she's like, do I believe in the ownership of guns in the Second Amendment? Yes. Do I believe in gun safety? Absolutely.
Do I believe in gun control?
Yes.
Yes.
And she said yes to that as well. And so the more we found out about this church, the more we just fell in love with it. And we started going to church.
Oh, and they were also got like, yeah, the main dude, Stuart. When we met him, he was like, oh, so what are you doing? We're like, oh, well, we're writers. He goes, oh, I'm a writer too. And we're like, we're thinking to ourselves, well, what's he going to be writing?
Yeah.
Okay. What do you write? Oh, you know, YA dystopian. I'm like, This is our church.
Yeah. So we hit it off with the church, and we've been. I mean, I can't think of a time I've been happier at a church. Which, if you know my background, that's saying a lot. But anyway, we're starting development on Dawn's Early Light, and Vinny had a blog post about how I don't want to say she prayed for a gun, but she said, Lord, if it's at all possible, I would love to have this certain kind of a cult gun with wooden handles. It had to be wooden handles. And sure enough,
her brother gave her mother's one.
And I mean, gorgeous. They're gorgeous guns. And I started picturing her, for some odd reason, wearing them under her vestments. and then I thought, Pip, I have an idea. So we write Vinny into Dawn's Early Light, and we just call her the priest. She is a bounty hunter, and she is hired to go after Wellington Books. And so we wrote this very elaborate scene
where she's
going to be bringing him in, all this stuff. But there's this, I wrote the opening scene, and in the opening scene, I mentioned the guns are prominently featured in there. She's getting communications from the House of Usher, all this great stuff. And I send it off to Vinny, because I wanted to get her approval to say, look, this is what we're going to be doing with your character. Are you okay with it? And the other thing, too, I wanted to make sure, there's this wonderful thing. She says, life is short and we do not have much time on this world. So
to gladden the hearts of others.
to gladden the hearts of others. So be swift to love. Make haste
make
to be
kind.
You know better than I do. But anyway, I just wanted to make sure.
She has this lovely saying that she says at the end of each service.
So we put that in the book, too.
And so we send it off to Vinny.
Right. So we send it off to Vinny for approval. And the following week, and we didn't hear anything. I was like, oh man, she hates it. And the following week, we walk into service and we're running a little late. And Vinny was actually coming from the back of the church for some reason on this particular Sunday. And as we're walking by, her, she grabs me. She goes, just so you know, I'm packing two pistols underneath my robes today.
You should start doing that.
Yeah,
and she just loves the idea.
She wasn't carrying pistols.
No, she wasn't carrying pistols. But that's what she said to us. We just had these big goofy grins on our faces throughout the entire service. And so now she is prominently featured in Dawn's Early Light. We were actually told by the editor, yeah, cut this character. I don't think it's needed. So what do we do to keep the character in there? We made her character bigger.
Made her more important.
Yeah, made her even more important. I just
realized we always have a lot of women in our books.
Which is nothing wrong with that.
I think men actually have a practically small.
No. We have Dawn's Early Light. I think it's
50-50.
It's 50-50. And I think
the Janus Affair was all about suffragettes.
It was all about chicks.
It was all chicks.
It was a taco buffet. I mean, that was not obscene. That was not obscene, okay? But
yeah.
It was, you know.
Vinny joins our cavalcade of tough chicks.
Of tough chicks. And it was fun. I got to admit, every scene we had fun with. Every scene we had fun with.
Well, that's wonderful. We're coming up to the end of our show here, but before we go, I wanted to ask you guys and have Rachel talk about for our audience whether Lent Madness. Do you guys do Lent Madness at your church?
Lent Madness.
Yes.
Have you heard about this?
Oh,
no.
Rachel, okay.
We're doing Lent. She gave up chocolate. I gave up beer.
These are time-honored classics of Lent.
Okay.
No, so Lent Madness, a couple priests in the Episcopal Church a few years back decided that an appropriate Lenten discipline would be to take 32 saints and pair them up in, like, NCAA March Madness style brackets.
Oh, my Lord.
And have people vote on them every day throughout Lent until they finally wheedle it down to the final saint who wins the golden halo.
So who won last year?
Last year was Frances Perkins. She's sort of more obscure. The first year C.S. Lewis won. Then it was Mary Magdalene.
I think we need to tell Vinny and Stuart about Lent Madness.
I'm sure they probably have heard. It seems to be growing in infamy every year.
Well, we're getting a big wall bracket for our church, right, Rachel?
Yeah, well, see, my boss is away. Awesome. My boss is on sabbatical, so while he's gone, I decided the appropriate thing to do would be to blow up a giant Lent Madness bracket poster and put it in the lobby of our church.
That's awesome.
So what do you do? Cross them off as they...
Yeah, cross them off as they...
You should put little martyred, you know, stamp.
Always look on the bright side of life. Wow.
So who's the favorite to win this year then?
Yeah, who's the money on?
Well, I'm just really sad because Christina the Astonishing already got, like, trumped by Basil the Great yesterday.
Yeah.
I mean, like she's, like, levitating saints.
Wow.
And just got trounced by, like, one of the formers of the Nicene Creed. Like, where's the fun in that?
Well, thank you guys so much. This has been incredibly educational, incredibly wonderful to hear your process and to hear about all the mischief that Katie gets up to when we don't see her here at church. And we really look forward to hearing more about Dawn's Early Light, and I look forward to finding out more about your guys' game. Do you have this is going to be coming out next weekend, so the 14th. What are sort of the last minute dates you want to get in our listeners' heads?
Wow.
25th of March is when Dawn's Early Light comes out. Tia's saying April is when the role-playing game will be out.
Wonderful. Let's see. Well, Weather Child, which was Pip's love letter, that's already been out. Her love letter to New Zealand. That's already out, and you can pick that up
at Amazon,
Barnes & Noble, and all those different places. Find out more about that at
pjballantine.com.
And then if this is dropping on the 14th, that means that on the 16th, so you'll have 2 days. On the 16th of March, the Kickstarter for The Curse of Dillinger's Diamond, a Bilbo Baddings mystery. You can find out all about that at tmorris.com. There are plenty of links that will take you back there. But that is my Kickstarter. It will have 2 days remaining. But right now, I'm focusing my eyes on the prize that within 11 days of you listening to this, Dawn's Early Light is going to be out, and we're looking forward to it. And you can keep up with us over at Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences. No, the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences.com. And, of course, there's our podcast,
Tales from the Archives, which can be found at Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences or on iTunes and all the other fine places.
I was talking about the other one, the shared desk. And that's at
theshareddesk.com. Yes.
Okay, well, that's wonderful. Thank you guys so much for being here. We're going to take us all out, as we try to do, with Debs and Errol's song. I think this one, this week, we'll go out with Commodore 64. So, from the world of faith, family, and fandom, in no particular order, geek out, y'all.
Just take those old floppies off the shelf. I load them up and play them by myself. Today's game.
On my Commodore 64, still like that Commodore.